Hi, everybody. And thank you for joining us today. The Samadoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network is very pleased and very honored to be joined today by Khaled Barakat, a Palestinian writer, a Palestinian leftist, and the international coordinator of the Campaign to Free Ahmed Sadat. We know that this is a difficult and challenging time for many people. You're concerned about your own health, about the health of your loved ones, and the health of your communities. We are, you know, locked in a global battle against a pandemic, one that is affecting people around the world, and one where we must say that countries like Cuba are presenting an example to the world of principled solidarity, even when we are seeing the devastating effects of untrammeled capitalism elsewhere in the world. Now, of course, in Palestine, there is, you know, the threat from COVID-19 and the threat of coronavirus is not something that is absent, far from it. The first 7 cases have been found in Gaza, and due to the siege, any widespread community spread of COVID-19 presents a serious threat to public health and wellness. And with it, the same is true within Israeli prisons, where medical neglect is a fact of life, even in the best time outside the prisons. And so what we're seeing inside the prisons is that the Israeli regime is using this as a chance to enact ongoing repressive measures against the prisons and even pull cleaning products and other items from availability at the prison store, making prisoners even more vulnerable at this time. And of course, incarcerated people, along with people who are homeless, people in countries who are subjected to US sanctions, are some of those who are most vulnerable at this time. Now, another thing that's happening is that our governments are carrying out almost unprecedented repressive measures. And many of these things may seem justified in order to protect public health, and people are willing to put up with a great deal of repression that they would not otherwise accept in the interests of preserving public health. At the same time, we are wary of where these measures will lead to after the pandemic, particularly because in many cases, these are the same governments from whom we face anti-Palestinian repression on an ongoing basis, and not just anti-Palestinian repression, but repression targeting communities of color, movements for social justice, national liberation movements around the world, and movements for change in any meaningful level. So there are a number of reasons why this discussion continues to be extremely relevant amid the ongoing global crisis. Now, before we get started, I just want to mentioned that there's a chat box. During the meeting, you can put any questions or comments that you have in the chat. This is being recorded. Later, there will be a question and answer session. If you want to ask your questions yourself, we can enable you to be able to do that. But if you want to not appear on video and you want to ask your question in the chat box, just put your chat in the box and we can present your question on your behalf. So just to let you know, those are the options. You can also always feel free to message me during the chat if you have any technical problems or difficulties with the event. And I will be providing some additional information via the chat box, relevant links to things that are being discussed and other information, so you can also go there. Now, before we get started, I just want to mention there are a couple of other webinars about Palestine that are also coming up that you might be interested in attending. I mean, at this time when we are committed to carrying out physical distancing that's necessary to protect each other and the health of our communities, we also think it's important to build our social collectivity and to continue to sustain our movements. So this evening at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, which is also 10 p.m. UTC, there will be a webinar on a frivolous lawsuit that's being filed against the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights and Palestine Legal we'll be discussing this and talking about another aspect of anti-Palestinian repression. And I'll paste the link to that in the chat. And this Saturday, March 28th at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. UTC, 6 p.m. Europe, 7 p.m. Palestine, there will be a Zoom webinar, a screening of Gaza's Fight for Freedom, and a discussion with the director, Abby Martin, that's being organized by the Boat to Gaza and some other organizations. And I'll also put the link to that in the chat as well. So we hope you'll be able to join those upcoming events. And please feel free also to put your own events in the chat as well. So you may have known this weekend was going to be an international weekend of action, and this whole week was an international week of action in solidarity with Gaza and in solidarity with the Great March of Return. And of course, the mass demonstration that was planned for 30th March, Land Day, is no longer taking place because in the interests of public health. And instead, Palestinians in Gaza are devising ways to build their collective solidarity and strength in order to protect each other from the threat of COVID-19 and also from the ongoing threat of Israeli occupation, apartheid, and siege, because the destruction and the devastation that threatens Gaza is not just from a virus, it's primarily from siege that's imposed by Israel with the full complicity of Egypt, the European Union, and the United States, among others, and Canada as well. So with that being said, I don't want to belabor this any longer. Just one additional note for those of you who are Arabic speakers, there is also a series of online discussions that are taking place in Arabic about the need for a revolutionary Palestinian movement. And Khalid has been participating in those events in Arabic. The next one is coming up on Sunday. You can find out about it on the Facebook page of Sami Doun, and I'll also post that in the chat as well. So with that being said, I don't want to take up any more of our time, and I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who is Khalid Barakat. Khalid is the international coordinator of the Campaign to Free Ahmed Saadat. He is a Palestinian writer, an activist, a leftist thinker, and someone who has been very involved in many movements for social justice. And so with that being said, I am going to introduce Khalid right now so that he can present to you. Thank you again.
Hello. I hope my voice is okay and you can hear me. First, let me wish you the best health, and please do take care of yourself in these difficult times that we're all facing. It's really important to be careful and to take this thing seriously. Let me begin by saying that it's this topic, fighting anti-Palestinian repression. It is needless to say that the aim of the system of oppression we face is that to create fear and deter people from demanding their rights and participating in the movement for justice. That's really the goal of oppression. And fear is that tool that it's often created and used by the state. Not only fear, but creating material threats to people's livelihood, you know, a form of a collective punishment. People might lose their jobs, in some cases, in others, people might lose their lives. Some people might lose their residency or their chance to obtain their papers. Either way, there are serious concerns behind that fear. Repressive states use their own structure as well as right-wing corporate media to promote fear and greater demands for, you know, quote-unquote, cracking down on people. They will utilize all branches of governments, executive, legislative, judicial, in order to reach that goal. So fighting oppression is fighting a very powerful machine, as you know. And as a result, people feel that they need to look for safety. And they may retreat from involvement or expressing their political views, thinking that this may provide protection for themselves. However, this protection rarely works. And perhaps the only real protection we have is that of a collective struggle and the power of the movement. When people fight back, they achieve rights and they can protect themselves. That's the only mechanism that people can protect themselves. Being silent or retreat does not protect you from oppression. And I want to speak about several examples of targeting an individual or a group of people and a collective punishment that aims to deterrence, you know, from the state point of view against an entire nation, against communities, and not just individuals. When communities are not living in their own land, especially in the case of migrants and refugees in particular, people feel vulnerable to the state. They are often fleeing oppression in their homeland and seeking safety. So they have extra level of insecurity and fear already. So they face denial of rights because you are not a citizen, threats that people will not receive their papers. These trigger the trauma that people have already lived through in many circumstances. The only option that oppressed communities have is to organize. This is the case of Palestinians. In order to fully understand our situation, we need to look at the system of oppression, but also the system of resistance, the response of oppression, in order to get and see the whole picture. I would like to use the example of when Israeli, for example, when Israel demolishes a Palestinian home. This home belongs to a family in a village of 10,000, maybe 15, 20,000 people. And they all have to see these bulldozers as they're demolishing this house. And then it is in the news and it reaches millions of people. So the message that spreads is that this home was demolished because a person who lived in it was a member of the Palestinian resistance. Now, these home demolitions violate international law. They are a form of a collective punishment against an entire family and an entire village. But when, you know, when people commit any crime, generally speaking, their entire family home is not demolished, even under the most repressive regimes. So in this case, we are not talking about criminal activity, but about resistance. Israel makes it clear the purpose of this action is what they keep repeating, is to teach Palestinians a lesson. And they always say that Palestinians don't learn, and so we have to teach them a lesson. And every time they carry an act of oppression, they use this term. And this is a term that colonizers use all the time. It is not just a Palestinian case, it is the relationship between colonizer and colonized people is that the colonizer wants to teach the people who are under his occupation or colonization what he calls a lesson. So we see the same thing, of course, with the devastating bombing in Gaza and with the mass arrest, when they arrest on a daily basis, 20 people, 30 people, 50 people in night raids, land confiscation. All of these are done in order to deter Palestinians from continuing to resist. So as Palestinians resist, there will be a reaction from the occupier, and then there will be a growing resistance. So we're talking about an action and a reaction. And so it is an open circle that does not end, because oppression requires resistance, and resistance is met with oppression, and so on and so forth. By all means, the balance of power between the oppressive state and resistance is in the favor of the state. But there are other factors that determine the balance of power, not just material power or material strength. And we'll get back to that in the discussion if you want. An example of that I often use in my talks is the position of Comrade Ahmed Saadat, General Secretary of the PFLP, when he delivered his speech in court. First, he boycotted the court, and that's an act of resistance. Then he said that he does not recognize the legitimacy of this court. And he said that the mere fact that I stood in this court so many times proves the failure of the occupation to break my will. The judge would say that you have been in this court so many times and you don't learn the lesson. And Saadat respond with, I have been here so many times because your state is a failure and your oppression does not work. So it is in this context that we understand the conflict between the two systems. Now, oppression of Palestinians outside Palestine, it's not disconnected or separated from oppression of Palestinians who suffers under occupation. Take, for example, in Lebanon, Palestinians face something akin to a state of siege in some camps, repressive laws of a racist nature that denies them jobs, equality, access to the health system, so on and so forth. In Jordan, Palestinians do not face this kind of exclusion as they do in Lebanon, but there is a fear that if they express their national aspiration and identity, this will lead to a division in the society because of the claim of the state. So there is a form of oppression. It is not declared, it is not in the legal system per se, but it is there. So, and it is a kind of siege. In the Gulf states, today there are Palestinian political prisoners in Saudi Arabia prisons. And people are always afraid of losing their jobs or being deported and so on and so forth. Palestinian communities in the United States or Europe face different kinds of oppression, but the final goal is to silence Palestinians and force them to accept the status quo, which is, of course, unacceptable. In this context, I want to talk about three examples today. The first one is a case known as the Holy Land Five. These are five Palestinian prisoners in the U.S. In previous years, Palestinians had been subjected to arrest, deportation, imprisonment in the United States. For example, we have the famous case of the Los Angeles 8 in the 80s. And it is part of the oppression system against the movement in the United States in general, people of color and migrants. So today, the most notable case is the five Palestinians who are serving prison sentences of up to 65 years in maximum security U.S. prisons. The least one of them got 15 years, and the highest sentence was 65 years. The main argument that the United States government used against them was to allege that they provided material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization, and in this case, Hamas. Now, this case happened during the Second Intifada, This was a case that involved a charity aid organization. That is all they were accused of. This isn't about them being members of an Islamic organization, or, you know, if you were to look at other liberation movements, you'll see similar cases in various countries targeting Turkish left movement, Kurdish, you know, Turkish, Kurdish movement, Colombian movements, Filipino, and so on and so forth. The purpose of these cases is to create fear in the exiled communities and prohibit the popular classes from receiving any kind of support from outside. Basically, to make people back home depends on the international aid and not an aid that comes unconditionally from their brothers and sisters or their supporters. Today we see Trump cutting funds for the UNRWA, funds that goes to Palestinian schools, hospitals, so on and so forth. And this, we were anticipating this, that it was coming, because it's mounting. It starts somewhere and it keeps mounting. They also want to forcibly separate the Palestinian community from their people back home. These five men are US citizens, but they are kept in the most harsh, restricted conditions. Family visits are extremely restricted. They are held in the notorious Supermax prison called the Communication Management Unit, and they are monitored 24/7. There is a campaign to release them, but often this type of campaigns is very difficult to build because of the nature of the allegation, and this is deliberate. People fear that they will also be targeted if they join the campaign to free the Holy Land fight, that they will also be labeled as Hamas supporters or terrorist supporters. These five did not commit, nor were they accused of any act of violence. They were very effective fundraisers for Palestinian charities. Now, the second case I want to talk about is the case of Comrade George Ibrahim Abdullah. As most of you know, he is a Lebanese communist struggler who has been imprisoned in France since 1984. He was originally supposed to be released in 1986. He has been in prison for over 35 years. An entire generation has been born while George was in French prison. He has been officially eligible for release since 1999. But the judiciary has approved his release several times, only to have it overridden by high-ranking French officials working in league with the United States and Israel. The question remains then, why is he still in jail? After all, he's supposed to be deported back to Lebanon. Why does France continue to hold him? Why do they keep him in jail until now? It is France, the US and Israel who have a direct interest in keeping him in jail, because they want to send a message to say that if you get involved in Palestinians or Lebanese resistance, you can remain in prison indefinitely and you have no rights. The second thing is their fear of George Ibrahim Abdullah's political role if he is released. He has refused to give any concessions on his principles and his political convictions. If he were to provide those political concessions, if he condemns himself, he would have been in Lebanon a long time ago. So he is consciously determined of praising the Palestinian revolution, the Palestinian resistance, and he is consciously upholding his principles. And they are aware of that same thing. They don't want an example of a secular progressive Lebanese resistance that win his freedom. France founded the Lebanese sectarian rotten system in Lebanon. They always want Lebanese politics, you know, to be framed as sectarian project or even Lebanese resistance, to be framed as a sectarian project. They like to label, you know, the current resistance led by Hezbollah as a radical Islamist trend. Well, when George Abdullah presents a different history and a different option of a secular resistance to imperialism and to Israel, although the communists and other progressive forces in Lebanon are not strong today, France still fears that people like George Abdullah can play a political and a symbolic role in reviving the Arab communist and progressive revolutionary forces to be more effective. We saw how the popular classes of Lebanon chanted for his release when the Intifada of October 17 broke out in Lebanon, and thousands of Lebanese and Palestinian youth learned about this struggler and this historical icon through their participation in the movement. Some of them had never even heard of the name George Abdullah. But how does George resist today in prison? He resists with his words. He tries to present a revolutionary perspective on the struggle of the Palestinian people and the Arab people. And he always do. He always expresses his solidarity with the oppressed people and political prisoners around the globe. He provides a vision for a new Arab progressive generation to be aware of, highlighting the role of colonization and repressing their dreams of freedom, equality, and justice. He voices his rejection to the attacks on Gaza. He refuses meals alongside Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and participate on their hunger strikes with them. So there are campaigns with George Abdullah, and we must organize for his release. And if you look at both cases, the Holy Land fight and George Abdullah, as it seems from the outside, it is between the United States versus, you know, five Palestinians, or the French state versus this one Lebanese individual. But Israel is in every detail of the two cases. Israel has always, met revolutionary Palestinian words of resistance with harsh repression. And this moves, you know, to the third case that I will talk about, which is my case with the German immigration authorities and the state. As some of you know, I was forbidden from giving a talk on June 22nd, 2019. I was invited by three Arab community organizations to speak about Trump's so-called deal of the century. And as Charlotte and I were, Charlotte and I were stopped by the police after we got off the train, the U-Bahn, and we were told the event was canceled. We were taken to the police station in Berlin, and I was told that I would have a political ban on me and that both of our applications for renewing our residency visa would be rejected. From their point of view, the state point of view, the natural thing that we should do is to accept the ban and not challenge this, in any way. And this is the scenario that they want to see. In that document, it says that I am forbidden from attending meetings or even social gathering with more than 10 people. And I was forbidden from giving any talks inside Germany. So we went to the European Parliament in Brussels. Last time I checked, Brussels is not part of Germany, so we can talk there. And we spoke about the repression in Germany targeting Palestinian organizing. Of course, this is not the only case. And so we discussed several of them, including the anti-BDS resolutions, the deportation of Rasmiya Ouda, criminal prosecutions of protesters in Germany. So the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, headed by racist right-wing minister Gilad Erdan. They got very angry about this, and they tried to say that we should never have been invited to speak to the parliament. They didn't want this issue raised at all. So, you know, now, of course, you know, many of you are familiar with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and Erdan and his huge budget to attack organizers for Palestine internationally. He is also the, you know, the oppressor of the Palestinian political prisoners, as he is also in charge of the, you know, prison authority in Palestine. So we see that this is not simply limited to the German government, but it is international in scope, and the Israeli state officially has a direct role in it. After the political ban ended, but before we left Germany, Sami Doun organized an event in Berlin where we spoke about these issues on August 17th. Both of these events, the European Parliament one and the August 17 event, were used as a justification for their latest attack, imposing a four-year ban on me entering Germany. All of these actions that we took were legal, political, public challenges to the repression, are now being used as reasons to ban me from entering Germany. So here we see again the cycle of oppression, resistance, and oppression again. So then we must resist. We must keep our campaign alive. Even according to German authority, this is a political case. They are not claiming, for example, that I engaged in any criminal behavior or that I advocated for violence in Germany, or engaged in any action. They recognize that. So it is very clear-cut political, in nature, and a very clear-cut case of freedom of expression. What they say essentially is the following, and I will summarize, you know, the 23 page document in short, in very, you know, 6 points. First, they say that I oppose the Oslo Agreement and the two-state solution, something that Germany officially supports. For them, that's a crime. Second, that I refuse to acknowledge Israel's right to exist, which they label as an anti-Semitic. Third, that I support Palestinian right to resist Israel. And fourth, that I could play a role in radicalizing what they called foreigners, which they mean, you know, the Arab and Palestinian communities, which could lead, according to their documents, to tensions between Arabs and Jews in Berlin. And that, of course, I call for the liberation of Palestine from river to sea, and that I support the BDS movement. And they also say that I support a Palestinian organization, and they name the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. By all accounts, all these allegations are political statements and political arguments. Germany wants to use the immigration authority to have a political argument rather than, you know, proving their point. In other words, if I support Oslo and the two-state solution, if I condemn Palestinian resistance, recognize Israel's right to exist, then it is fine. Then I can stay in Germany and I can, you know, go back to Germany. So these conditions are fundamentally unacceptable and are refused, not just by me, by all Palestinians, or the vast majority of them. These reflect the positions of the Israeli state, the definition of what is a good Palestinian versus what is a bad Palestinian. And so, you know, to be a good Palestinian, then you must, you know, submit to the Israeli conditions and German conditions and United States conditions and so on and so forth. Now, these conditions have a, you know, we have, Palestinians have, our narrative and positions across the board. Palestinians support BDS. Across the Palestinian spectrum, Palestinians fight for the right of return of Palestinian refugees. These are national constants. And have a Palestinian popular consensus targeting of an individual is just an attempt to create an example. You know, Germany does not want to put thousands of Palestinians in jail or in the immigration courts in Berlin. It's too hard to do, too much work for them. So they want to say, here is an example. If you do what this guy do or say what he says and advocate for these positions, you could lose everything. So the target is not, you know, Khaled Barakat. It is the broader community at large. These conditions and this set of German official positions give us a tool to expose this system of oppression and to show how the so-called democratic Germany really works and actually operates, especially for non-citizens. It is also, it suggests for us to build for an alternative relationship between the Jewish and the Arab communities in Germany, a progressive coalition that fights racism and fight right-wing forces. And this is including in Palestine and in Germany alike. It also allows us to link our struggles with other movements who also face similar forms of challenges and repression in Germany, particularly within the communities of color, refugees and migrants communities, as in the case of the Kurdish and the Turkish left movement. Now, 2 days ago, the lawyer representing me in this case, submitted an appeal, which will now be moving forward. So we are continuing the legal challenge against this injustice by the German state. I'm continuing to speak to the media as well as, you know, these kinds of forums, especially given the Corona situation. Now, I don't think that the German state was exposed among Palestinians as clearly as it was by this case, because Germany also attempted to market itself in the Arab world, you know, as a potentially neutral party and a country that upholds international law, when it is actually, you know, harshly aligned with Israel and is willing to throw international law in the garbage can. As we can, you know, clearly see with their position at the ICC, the International Criminal Court, as well as their, you know, disregards for civil and political rights in this case. There's also the reality of the relationship between the German and the broadly European far right, including parties like AfD, as well as the, you know, nominally centrist parties. Their relationship with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, you know, and the Israeli state as a whole, we see that these forces are not interested in actually fighting anti-Semitism and racism, but instead, you know, transferring responsibility to a colonized people made refugees, the Palestinian people. They want to, you know, blame Palestinians for their crimes. So, you know, they want to actually create victims of Palestinians more than one time. They are actually trying to address a fear of their own, you know, but not the fears they claim. Instead, the fear, of the ability of the oppressed to organize themselves and win their freedom and express, their true, genuine relationship with their people in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Yemen, in the Philippines. This fear among the state also grows as they become more aware of communities, of color and migrants, communities organizing themselves and growing and becoming more and more stronger. The state show their real face when it comes to Palestinian and Arab women when they silenced Rasmiya Ouda and Darin Tatour. Their event, Rasmiya and Darin event, was officially banned by the Interior Senator of Berlin on March 15, 2019. They are afraid of the young generation speaking about, martyrs like Basil Al-A'raj, a young Palestinian intellectual who was murdered by Israel. All of their so-called commitment to equality or to youth participation is cast aside if they do not fulfill, the conditions. I want to conclude by saying that final oppression is really the meaning of resistance and what defines resistance. We must energize all of our campaigns and efforts together and in all levels and truly build for a united front. When we look at the cases of individuals, it is really a collective case. And we must, today more than ever, uphold the principle of one for all and all for one. So join the campaign to fight for the freedom of the Holy Land Fife and the freedom of George Ibrahim Abdullah and the freedom of all political prisoners around the world. And I thank you so much again for participating in this forum. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for your meaningful and powerful remarks. I just want to note that, first of all, I apologize for the mental thoughts about racist, misogynist, and homophobic remarks in the chat. There was a poll. Those trolls will remove, and we change the chat box so that your chat questions go to the hosts only. So please feel free to put your questions in the chat or let me know if there's something that you would like to announce and say, and then we can go from there. I also I was distracted. Apparently I was having an echo. And apologies about that. So I'm going to ask a question to Khaled, and then I'm going to mute myself so that we don't have so much of the echoing. Before we move on, I just want to say that we also recognize, of course, that anti-Palestinian repression is one part of the fabric of repression. Repression targeting indigenous communities, particularly in North America, in the United States and Canada, and repression targeting other liberation movements. So for example, we see the attacks on Turkish and Kurdish comrades in Germany as well, and also in Greece, where there was just a raid last week on the offices of the Anti-Imperialist Front, and I'll put a link about that in the chat as well. So the first question that I received for Khaled is a question about the role of the Palestinian Authority and whether they should be criticized for failing to do enough to protect Palestinian prisoners or even imprisoning Palestinians themselves.
I'm sorry, I was speaking and I was on mute. The PA is absolutely complicit in this cycle of oppression. They are what we call subcontractor. They target Palestinian resistance on behalf of Israel and under the so-called security cooperation. They're very much similar to the collaborator authority of the government of Fiji in France during the Nazi occupation. And they are similar to other governments who are placed by the colonizer in order to be a mediator between the colonizer and the people. The very first thing that a colonizer do is they establish some local entity that speaks the language of the people because they're not interested in talking to the people. And usually they pick classes that serve them. In the Palestinian case, the Palestinian Authority, not just that they're complicit, but they're not interested in defending Palestinians even outside or inside Palestine. The Palestinian embassies, for example, they do nothing when it comes to oppression Palestinian space, whether by Israel or any other entity. We saw, for example, that they couldn't protect, comrade Omar Naif when he went to one of their embassies, in Sofia in Bulgaria, and they were, conspiring with the government and with Israel against Omar Naif. So the PA is a reactionary force that has no interest in defending Palestinians. They are guilty, in fact. That's my answer.
Thank you so much, Khaled. And I just wanted to see, I don't see a lot of other questions here in the chat. Oh, here. I have a question about the case of a person known as Carlos Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, and if this is a case that we should also be following. And this is a question from a lawyer who works heavily on political prisoner cases in Colombia and elsewhere.
Absolutely. And, Carlos was involved in the Palestinian resistance for many years. And he is today in French prisons. It is important that people voice their solidarity with Carlos and with others as well. Now, usually in these kind of cases, our reference should be the prisoner themselves, their families, or their political parties, because we don't want to speak on behalf of someone without having them as a reference to us. They tell us how to support them and how to organize for, because they know their cases and their interests more than we do. So my advice is that a direct communication with Carlos and with his lawyer would be the best way to tackle his case.
Thank you so much, Khaled. I just received a couple more questions, which is great. Keep those questions coming in. The next question is, what is this? And this goes back to the way that you connected
the situation of anti-Palestinian repression outside Palestine to the repression of Palestinians inside Palestine, in particular, the ongoing mass imprisonment directed against Palestinians. And so the question is, what is the situation now of the Palestinian student prisoners? Because we've recently seen a big kind of attack on the Palestinian student movement and arrests of a number of prominent Palestinian students. So what's happening with those cases now?
Yes, the Palestinian student movement is constantly under pressure and facing mass arrest, not by Israel only, but also the PA. There are several student leaders of the student movement in the PA prisons today. But in the context of fighting the occupation, the student movement is always under attack. Particularly the cadres of the student movement who are trying to link the struggle of students with the Palestinian people's struggle in general. When they address the issue of prisoners in campuses, when they fight for student rights, when they are engaged in the liberation struggle, usually Israel try to cripple any campaign that is carried by the students. And this is, you know, most students are youth, so it is an attack on Palestinian youth and that energy that Israel feels. The other thing is that the campuses in Palestine has been always places for organizing and resistance, and Palestinian students are very much an integral part of the Palestinian movement. Some of the, you know, some of them, especially the one who is active, have been in administrative detention more than one time. And this administration detention is really a tool that Israel has inherited from the British colonizers, and they use it on a daily basis against Palestinian students. So what does this do? It actually blocks students from graduating, from continuing with their education. It interrupts their lives and the lives of their family. And it also creates this fear, you know, amongst students in general. And most importantly is, you know, the raids that has happened recently against students from Bir Zeit University as being one of the most active campuses in Palestine. So it is... It is an attack that dates to the first day of the occupation, and it will continue as long as occupation continues.
Thank you so much. So we've gotten a few more questions, and you know, one of the things that's come up in a lot of these cases is that we're not having as many updates as we usually have, because military courts are being canceled due to COVID-19, prisoners aren't being transported, but we're also hearing about a lot of other repressive measures that it seems like the Israeli prison system is implementing mostly as plans that they already had for repression, rather than as any real attempt to contain the virus, given the lack of access to sanitary supplies and medical neglect. So we've heard about some planned protest actions by prisoners in response to this. And what do you know about what's happening with the prisoners and their response to the threat of the coronavirus?
Well, first, generally speaking, usually prisoners, whether they're political prisoners or whether we're talking about, you know, in general, when something like this happened, you know, when even an earthquake happened or tsunami or, some kind of a disease happen. They are very vulnerable. They're very vulnerable because first they are kept in the, you know, what you can call the enemy line. So, you know, we don't trust Israel and what Israel record with Palestinian prisoners, you know, makes Palestinians very worried and nervous about their sons and daughters in Israeli prison. The prisoners themselves issue a statement saying that, you know, we are vulnerable. We are we don't trust the prison authority. We're asking for a Palestinian medical teams, international medical teams, to go inside the prisons and to do, you know, fact-finding missions, you know, from the World Health Organization, the Red Crescent, and other international agencies to overlook the Palestinian prisoner situation. Now, we are demanding for the release and the freedom of all Palestinian prisoners, and especially at these times. You know, also Palestinians are vulnerable to all kinds of rumors, you know, and this doesn't help. It makes the situation more tense. I know that Samidun and Abdamir and other organizations have been actively highlighting the situation of the prisoners. But they, you know, as Charlotte mentioned, sometimes lack of, you know, credible information, lack of visits, lawyers cannot have full access to prisoners. This makes the situation difficult. We're also demanding the release of political prisoners in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia and you know, all Arab prisons, not just Israeli prisons, because of the very same reasons. So it's really important that we pressure Israel as much as we can these days and these coming weeks to allow for international you know, medical delegations to go and check the situation of the Palestinian political prisoners.
Thank you so much. So we've definitely been continuing to get a bunch of questions. And the next question that we have sort of swings back to the repression of Palestinians outside Palestine, which is a case that you talked about earlier, the case of Omar Nayef, who is a, I mean, you talked about this case earlier on and how he sought protection. He's a former Palestinian political prisoner who actually was one of the few prisoners who managed to escape and lived in Bulgaria for decades. He suddenly, right before the statute of limitations on his initial escape was to expire, Israel sought to arrest him, and he sought protection in the Palestinian Authority's embassy, which is recognized fully as a state in Bulgaria, so it has all of the protections under international conventions accorded to an embassy. Nevertheless, Omar Nayef never left the embassy alive. And if people are interested, there's a lot of information about this case on our website, samidun.net. I'll put a link down below. He never left the embassy alive. He was found dead there. And you know, many people credibly believe that he was assassinated within the walls of the embassy. And so the question is, what's going on with the case now? Is there any ability to hold those accountable who were responsible for his death or who failed to protect him?
Well, I mean, in principle, regardless of the argument that says that he was not assassinated, he never came out alive. He was, you know, there is certain entities who are responsible of his life, and that is Israel, the Bulgarian government, and the Palestinian embassy. Now, there were no real investigation from any of these parties, especially the Palestinian Authority. There was no real accountability. The, you know, even the Palestinian ambassador was never questioned in real terms of his role and his responsibility. No actions were taken. The PA wants to close this file and they are not interested in talking about it because it exposes their policies in general and in this case in particular. The PFLP have issued a statement in last month saying that they are going to keep continuing investigating and demanding, justice for Omar Naif and his family. And so this is an open wound, an open case, and it's also really important to pressure the Palestinian side and the Bulgarian side of coming up clear on the information that they have.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your response on this. Now, we had, just so people know, I know some people have just joined the chat recently. We've had a number of trolls on the chat, so it's closed and people are muted. If you would like to make a comment, please type it into the chat box and we will present it. So I just want to let the new folks know who have joined. We're going to be wrapping it up soon, but I do want to make an announcement on behalf of the Zionism is Racism campaign, because as we all know, and as we've been talking about, this isn't an isolated example. This isn't an isolated case. First of all, in Germany, it's not an isolated case. As Khaled spoke about the deportation of Rasmia Oda and the banning of her event along with Doreen Tatour in Berlin, there are Palestinian from Gaza and two Israeli Jewish protesters who interrupted a speech by a member of the Knesset and are facing criminal prosecution because of that. We saw the anti-BDS resolution passed by the Bundestag, which was supposed to be something that was not legally binding, but it's referenced like five times in the 23-page document in Khaled's case. Jewish Voices for a Just Peace was the first Jewish organization in Germany since the Nazi era to have its bank account shut down. These are just a few examples of what's happening in Germany, but it's not just happening in Germany. In the United States, there are anti-BDS laws that are being passed. The use of lawfare for frivolous lawsuits, like is going to be discussed tonight in the Palestine Legal webinar. And in the United Kingdom, there are also attacks. So recently at a protest in Nottingham, one of the protesters, specifically a Black protester, was targeted by the police and arrested for participating in this protest. And now those charges are not being pursued, which is a victory for the people who have been organizing around this case, the Zionism is Racism Defense Campaign. However, it's important that they successfully fought this attempt to impose charges on this activist for protesting for Palestine. And they were going to be holding a follow-up protest this Saturday, but of course, due to COVID-19, that is not going to be taking place. But in Nottingham, there will be an online event about Zionism is Racism defense campaign and the organizing that they're doing. So I'm gonna post their Facebook page and the link so in the chat so that people will be able to join this. Now, I have another question here about the Palestinian Authority, which is something you've been talking about a few times. It was, someone is asking if Palestinians would be able to change the Palestinian Authority or do something about this situation as part of the struggle for liberation from, settler colonialism, apartheid, and occupation.
Of course, I mean, Palestinians at the end are going to have to change this PA. I mean, if they cannot do it today, they will be able to do it, you know, in the near future or in the future. But that's something that we should struggle in order to achieve it, you know, because at the end, this Palestinian Authority is the authority of the 1% of the Palestinian capitalists who are benefiting from occupation and who are benefiting from their status. These are, you know, 50 or 100 people, literally. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a Palestinian class in the sense that, you know, exists in the West. But they are the one with the power. And even though they are subordinate to Israel, and even though, you know, they are having this economic and security cooperation with Israel, but at the same time, they lack legitimacy. The PA was established outside of the frame of the Palestinian institutions, national institutions. It was established not with the approval of our people. It is a product of the Oslo Agreement, in which Palestinians never gave their approval to such agreement. And all of that is important in order for us to say that this is an illegitimate entity. Now, the PLO is a different case. But the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Gaza does not represent Palestinians, even though today they are the one who have the political power and not the PLO. The PLO is kind of in a clinic almost, you know, dying. It is just a frame. It doesn't have any real teeth. When we see that the major forces are not participating in the PLO, that means that it lacks legitimacy, it lacks political legitimacy. Even organizations like the PFLP does not participate in the PNC or the Palestinian National Congress, the Palestinian Central Council. They don't attend the Palestinian Executive Committee meetings. They don't participate in any delegations by the PLO. The same goes on Hamas and Islamic Jihad and many other Palestinian resistance groups. So the PLO is the place for forces that is really outside the frame of resistance. It's basically run by one group, that it's Fatah, and the factions that goes along with Fatah. So yes, the PA must be defeated, their program must be defeated, and Palestinians, whether they're in Palestine, in the entire land of Palestine, not just the West Bank and Gaza, and in the Shatat, must unite in order to change the status quo and build for a revolutionary alternative.
Thank you so much. We just had one more comment or question from Abraham Weitzfeld, who was asking about, who was talking about the aid that Cuban doctors are providing around the world regarding COVID-19 and coronavirus, and asking if you knew anything regarding whether Palestinians will be and Palestine will be receiving Cuban aid in this regard. And also more broadly, what are your thoughts about internationalism today and how internationalism and, you know, imperialism are being reflected in this current crisis?
Well, when it comes to Cuba aid to Palestine, it is not just recently. Since the victory of the revolution in Cuba, and we have been receiving student scholarships. Thousands of Palestinian students graduated as doctors from Cuba. Most of the scholarships that we receive from Cuba is in the medical field. So, you know, generations of Palestinians have actually received this support from Cuba and from Venezuela now as well. Until today, Cuba provides scholarships, not like before, much less, but it's still happening. As for the latest situation, my understanding is that there has been a communication between Palestinian factions and the Cuban embassies in Lebanon. I don't know where these efforts have led to, but I assume that Cuba will not hesitate of providing help for Palestinians. That's not a problem. For internationalism today, you know, that's really a very important question and a very tough one as well, because in, you know, 30 years ago, we had the Soviet Union and the Socialist Bloc, regardless of any position about that, but there was a camp there. Today, unfortunately, the entire world is very much under the capitalist and capitalism, you know, framework and regulations. And the attempts that we see of breaking from this, the chains of the dollars and the chains of US domination and all that will absolutely create different dynamics in the future. But today, the popular movements must be the answer for building internationalism in the in a more free and based from bottom up, building from bottom up, and not wait for a kind of a center of a state and not be able to move forward. And I think that, you know, there is efforts on a regional level, but it keeps, it is slow. Like, take for example, the relationship amongst the left and the revolutionary movements in the Arab world, or the Middle East. You know, if we cannot build a united front in our region, we are not going to be able to move forward on an international level. There are, the local and the regional tasks that will lead to a more of an international answer. That does not mean that we should wait. I mean, all these struggles that it's happening today must be more interlinked, but not just based on political party framework. You know, I think it should be more expanded to grassroots and popular movements in general. Now, if we don't want this system that is dominating today's world, we must not shy from saying that we are for socialism. Because sometimes there is this problem of introducing some liberal ideas as if it's a leftist ideas or revolutionary ideas, and people get mixed up, you know. In short, I can say that, you know, we're looking forward to, you know, the Black Liberation Movement in the United States, the building up their strength, because they're in the, you know, belly of the beast, and in the West as well, you know, these movements can play a role not just in confronting imperialism, but also uplifting the international front in general. The same goes for Palestinians. Palestinians have played a very central role in the 70s, but today, what is the responsibilities of the Palestinian movements in, you know, from an international perspective? So I guess it's important to address these tasks internally and locally, but also find a framework to do that.
Thank you so much. So I have one more question, one final question for Khaled that I'd like to ask him. And then I'll come on to do some wrap-ups and ask Khaled for some final thoughts. But so the and thank you so much to everyone who has joined us today. I've been receiving a few questions about this. So I do want to let people know that we will be continuing our webinars as Sami Dune. And we also have some information about some upcoming webinars organized by other groups that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk and put in the chat, but I'll put them in the chat again at the end as well. But so, Khaled, my next question for you is, this is one that we received, which is, can you speak more to the situation of the right of return, especially given the level of kind of organizing against it and attempts to suppress it by various actors that are taking place today?
And I mean, the right of return is for Palestinian refugees is the core of the Palestinian cause. And it is always subject to attacks and liquidation because refugees are subject to attacks. And we see that Palestinian refugees today are being, oppressed on so many levels in order not to organize for the right of return. When people are living under very harsh conditions in the camps, it'd be very hard for them to mobilize for the right of return because they keep them busy trying to deal with their daily lives and challenges. When you don't have, you know, clean water in Shatila refugee camp, people will face more and more difficulties. So it goes hand in hand. The strength of the Palestinian refugees and the supporting of their situation will help in reviving the movement for the right of return in a real sense. And when I say that, I mean that Palestinians outside, especially in surrounding Palestine, start to be engaged in with the resistance in all levels under the banner of return. And the same time, re-energize the popular movements, especially in places like Europe today, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees are living there in the 80s and 90s.